Welcome back, baseball amigos, to episode 65 of the Nats GM Show, sponsored by No Halftime, the only podcast available via the Nats GM Radio Network. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the baron of all baseball podcasts. So you ask, what is No Halftime? Well, you're staring at your weekly fantasy opponent and thinking to yourself, I would love to challenge just one of his players, not his entire team. But your fantasy sports service currently doesn't allow you to. Now you can with the all-new No Halftime app. The No Halftime app allows you to create individual challenges using players or teams. For example, you can pit Bryce Harper versus Mike Trout, Miguel Cabrera versus Dee Gordon, or Chris Davis versus Matt Kemp. Creating a challenge takes seconds, and accepting challenges is even easier. No Halftime challenges can be private or public and created for the MLB, the NFL, NBA, NHL, PGA, and other sports. Join today and get started. Real money and fantasy supremacy awaits you. And now, you can also try No Halftime for free with $0 challenges. Visit NoHalftime.com for more information and to download the No Halftime app for your iPhone or Android device. Receive a bonus by entering in the promo code NATSGM at sign up. Receive a free t-shirt when you make a deposit. No Halftime, where the fantasy sports season never takes a break. And now to our guest.
Hi, this is Matt Jackson of the Young Bucks, best tag team in professional wrestling, and you are listening to the Nats GM Show. Too sweet me.
And now, I am pleased to welcome author from 538, a first-time guest of the show, Rob Arthur. Rob, welcome to the Nats GM Show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
It's been, like I was saying to you off-air, it's been a few months since I've seen you. I guess I met you and got to spend a little time with you at Sabre Seminar 2015. And the work that you've been doing recently at 538 has just been outstanding, so I had to have you on.
Well, thanks for letting me come on.
Definitely. Thank you for coming on, and I want to dive in first and foremost into your most recent column entitled, if I have it right, Stat Heads Are the Best Free Agent Bargains in Baseball.
Yep.
I want to give you, if without a better way to say it, just the floor to kind of introduce what you and Ben Lindbergh were striving for in this piece and a little bit about what your research found.
Sure. So we started off with this question of, basically, how has analytics grown in MLB over the last few years? We know that some of the most saber-savvy front offices are doing really well right now, in particular the Cubs, right? And we wanted to see how that growth in analytics has proceeded over time, and to see also if we could measure whether analytics actually provides some advantage on the field in terms of wins and losses. So we basically looked through a bunch of media guides and team web pages to assign a number of analytics staff to each team at three different time points. So the present, 2016, then 2012, and 2009 as well. And we looked up how many quantitative people there were at each of those times, full-time quantitative employees.
Now, when you say quantitative, what does that encompass? Is that anybody doing data? Is that what would that fall under?
So we had to make some judgment calls in certain cases, but basically what we're looking for is someone who is spending a majority of their hours doing statistical research.
Okay.
Or some kind of data processing thing, some task like that.
And you're doing your best to educatedly guess that, I'm sure.
Yes. And we checked with many different front offices and asked people, and despite that, we couldn't get clear answers out of everyone, and we couldn't get 100% accuracy, obviously. So these are really estimates of how many analytics staffs there are, but we're pretty confident that they're close to right, and more so, I guess, for the most recent numbers than further back, since there are some people that sort of dropped out of baseball, and then and we couldn't get information on what they were doing, obviously, in 2009. So they're estimates, but I think they're good estimates of how many analytics people there are in each front office.
So what have we seen, or what did you guys see from the evolution of 2009 to today?
Well, it was pretty amazing. I mean, Ben put it as a, sort of a Moore's Law explosion in terms of how many people are working on analytics in front offices. It went from it went from 44 in 2009 to 75 in 2012, and then more than doubled to 2016 to 156. So it's just blown up. You know, there's more people working on that side of things than ever before, and it's, you know, doubled in the span of 4 years. That's really incredible.
And what did you, or why do you hypothesize that we've seen such a growth in that area?
Well, this goes back to one of the other points in the piece that we wanted to address, is like whether these all these new analysts are actually effective in improving on-field performance. So we looked at that, and we found that the teams that invested earliest, so the teams that had analytics people in 2009, they did much better than expected. They did about 7 wins higher than expected from 2012 to 2016. So if the team got on the analytics side early, if they invested in it early, they were able to realize some really impressive gains in their performance later on. So I think the reason that we're seeing this huge explosion is because it's effective, and it's a really good investment from a team perspective, because analytics is pretty cheap. Individual employees don't get paid all that much. And if they're adding, let's say, 2 wins a year, and you're only having to pay them, you know, pay for a whole analytics department maybe $1 million or $2 million, then that's a really incredible win per dollar estimate, probably better than even a really incredible rookie. You're getting a better return on your investment there.
So, and you and Ben both hypothesize in the piece, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you guys say that you don't think that this has hit the plateau mark yet.
No, I mean, the fact that it grew so much from 2012 to 2016 suggests that it's still going. And the other thing that was interesting that we found along the same lines is that early on, it seemed like the small market teams kind of tended to have an advantage. So like the canonical example is the Tampa Bay Rays, right? They were early into the analytics game, and they did really well because of it. But what we've seen recently is that now the big market teams are realizing that they can get a big return on their investment by investing in analytics. So now you have the Yankees staffing up, you have the Dodgers staffing up, you have the Cubs staffing up to an even higher degree. So all of these teams that these rich teams are seeing what the poorer teams can do with analytics, and they're even buying more and more capacity. So I think it's going to keep going for some time.
Is the talent still out there in terms of, I mean, the early people that you could get and hire are typically, you know, the most talented, and then you keep diving deeper into a pool and you start getting lesser and lesser candidates. Is the quality still out there for being hired, so to I guess, for lack of any better way to put it?
Oh, I mean, that's a really interesting question. We couldn't really get any data on that. I mean, one thing I've seen personally is that the requirements for a front office job have gotten so much more impressive than they used to be. It used to be that if you had a bachelor's degree in some kind of quantitative field, you were pretty qualified to work in an MLB front office. Now, if you look at the most recent job postings, they're asking for PhDs in computer science or mathematics, things like that. And the thing about it is, those people, the people with PhDs in computer science, typically they have very lucrative jobs available to them outside of baseball. And the jobs within baseball don't pay all that well, and they are asked to do quite a lot of work. So I think that they're sort of starting to hit – they might be starting to hit a wall where they have gotten most of the people that are really talented that will work for how little they're paying and will work as hard as they require. Now they're going to have to do something to recruit people with these advanced degrees, with really impressive resumes, who could easily go find jobs that will pay 3 times as much in another industry. So it'll be fascinating to see how the front offices negotiate that. I mean, that might be the new sort of inefficiency. Maybe we'll see the Rays starting to offer 3 times the salary that they usually offer in order to get someone who's more qualified.
And that was the note that I had kind of in this section of your piece, was how does the effect of the stock market and investment banking, which has been I don't know, you're at a younger age, you can probably have a better sense of it, but it's certainly not been as hot as it was maybe when I was coming out of college. Has that slowdown had any effect of, well, the same candidate who may have gone into investment banking is now going into baseball?
That's interesting. I think early on there were actually – this is just my educated guess, but I think early on there were actually more people coming over from investment centered occupations. Nowadays, I think we've seen less of it, but it could be that as more of these jobs become available, we'll see more of it again. I mean, the thing about it is, even if the investment sector has kind of slowed down a little bit, it's still so much higher paying of a job than you're going to get in baseball. So they're still really trying to get people on the basis of their love for the game, which is certainly a viable way to recruit people, but I think they're running out of people who are willing to give up a lot of money and a lot of prestige working at an investment bank to go work for a baseball team.
Very true. That's incredibly true. The other part of the piece that I wanted to talk to you about a little bit as well is you and Ben noticed that there wasn't necessarily, with the addition of the analytics departments, and I believe you used the term quant, there was not a decrease in the number of scouts or quote-unquote old-school baseball people from these teams. In fact, they were adding to those departments as well.
Yeah, that was interesting. I mean, this all came from the bit in Moneyball where they said that there's this sort of scouts versus stats divide. And I think that that's really been shown over the past few years to be a false dichotomy. Analytics people are very excited about scouting because it gives them information that they couldn't necessarily get from the stats alone. And what we saw was that although teams are investing more in analytics, they're also investing more in scouting. That's a really valuable way to get additional data, is to hire more scouts who will go out and grade players that you might not necessarily be able to get pitch FX data on or hit FX data on. But a scout can go and say, well, the ball really comes off his bat, and that's kind of like a piece of information about their exit velocity in a certain way. So this false dichotomy, we found it not to be borne out in the data at all. All of the teams, I think, except for five or so, invested in more scouts as well as more statistical personnel.
So, and like we alluded to a second ago, or I said a second ago, you don't see this slowing down. You see this continuing to rise. Kind of my economics background, when do we hit the law of diminishing returns? You get 10 people in a kitchen, all of a sudden you can't create as many things as if you had 9. Where is that plateau, I guess, is the word I'll use, in terms of hiring?
Right, that's really fascinating. Having not been a full-time employee in a front office myself, I've been a consultant before, and I've worked on the outside on individual projects, but I've never been in the thick of it. And it does seem to me, I agree with you, that if you started getting really huge dozens of people in a front office, you'd think there would be sort of a loss of efficiency and too many people with too many different viewpoints to ever get kind of a coherent strategy. But at the same time, if you have maybe it points to the fact that they're just needing more effective leadership and to sort of divide up the work and be more organized about it. I don't think that time of it certainly doesn't seem, based on the data, that the time of diminishing returns is happening yet. But maybe that will come up soon. And that also connects to the question that we sort of discussed earlier about whether the talent had all sort of been picked. It may be that in the future, instead of competing to add just another quant or just another three quants on your team, you're competing to add really the best analyst from some other team. And so you might have sort of a free agent battles in terms of that, given that it doesn't pay as much to add three more people. It pays a lot better in terms of your on-field performance to add someone that's really good, one person that's really good. That would be interesting, and I'm really curious to see how it'll play out in the future.
Well, and that gives me kind of a decent little way to segue into the final point that I wanted to ask you about in the piece, and you both pointed it out. I don't have the number in front of me, but I think there are three females hired at this point in the quant analytics kind of domain, and once again, that's probably not the right word, but How do we go about, first of all, this has been one of my things, is getting more women involved in the front office, and is that a place where maybe the applicant pool is stronger than maybe the male Caucasian pool that's been more picked over?
Yeah, I think that's probably the case, that there's probably, I mean, we've seen front office people say that there's almost certainly a bunch of qualified female people that either don't apply or don't get hired, but that would be excellent analysts. Actually, a funny note about the three female analysts, we actually got an email from a R&D person to say that they'd hired someone else, so it was up to four now, just recently, I guess. It is a problem, I think, in terms of the diversity of front offices, and I think getting people with more diverse backgrounds, not just in terms of gender, but in terms of race, which we couldn't really analyze with the data that we had, but more racial diversity, probably it would also be good to have more occupational diversity, since, as you alluded to, a lot of these guys are coming from finance. You don't want to have sort of all one type of person or one background in your front office. That would seem to encourage a lot of groupthink. So the more they're able to recruit diverse people, I think the more effective it'll be, and also just the more equitable it will be to women and to other races. As to how to do that, I'm not really sure. I think that, one thing which I'll come back to is that they should probably just offer better incentives. Right now, like I said, the pay is so bad and the hours are so long that the only people they're getting are the people that have this like incredible, absurd, almost pathological love for baseball and are willing to give up significant career opportunities and maybe make their families a little bit unhappier in order to have this opportunity. If they incentivize it a bit more, maybe they would have a more diverse applicant pool to pick from, and maybe they'd be able to get some more women and some more other races and some more different occupations. Whether we'll see that happen, I don't know. And whether that will be effective even, I'm not sure. It's certainly not the case that there aren't women that love baseball every bit as much as men. So there must also be some other problems, some other issues preventing women from getting hired.
Well, can go into a much bigger socioeconomic conversation, but it starts at the intern level as well with, it's a lot – the odds are a lot stronger that the white male who's got, two parents who are wealthier is going to have a better opportunity to take that internship than somebody that's struggling more, economically. So.
Oh, absolutely. That's a huge part of it, and it starts, I think, even before that. I mean, just recently we've seen stuff about, I don't know if you saw that that video about women being harassed, women sports writers being harassed on Twitter. There was a whole kerfluffle recently about the lack of diversity on a baseball panel event. I think that there's pretty much at every step of the way, there's a strong advantage given to white males in terms of getting these jobs and in terms of getting to a position where they could get these jobs. So that's something that has to be resolved and probably has to be resolved by everyone, all of us, not just the people in the front office, but all of us taking some role in encouraging women and a more diverse group more generally to go after these jobs.
Yeah, I think Jessica Mendoza may be a perfect example of seeing the kerfuffle, that word you used, over her hire, and now with her success, maybe that does open a door for more women to see that, hey, that is an opportunity, and perhaps that opens more doors, so to speak, for the front office or just other parts of the game.
Yeah, I hope so.
So I don't know how to transition off that column, but I'd like to talk a little bit about some of your hitting columns, particularly the two you've written in the last couple weeks, because they both blew my mind, and we haven't talked a lot of hitting recently on the show.
Sure.
So you wrote about 2 weeks ago, give or take, when everybody's downloading this, a column called The New Science of Hitting on 538, which anybody that's listening to this obviously should go read it. But the thing that I found interesting was you were kind of talking about the information that we've been gathering now from StatCast about exit velocity and about launch angle. And maybe I'll stop there and let you kind of start from there.
Yeah, so my sort of objective with this column was to contextualize that information. So you've probably seen like a bunch of tweets online about how, you know, Giancarlo Stanton hit a ball at 105 miles per hour at a launch angle of 20 degrees or something. And it's hard to understand what that means if you don't have any background in what's an average exit velocity and what's an average launch angle. What is that? What do balls that are hit at that exit velocity and that launch angle, where do they go? Are they home runs? Are they doubles? Are they outs? You know, so what I was trying to do with this piece was to sort of get people oriented to what launch angle means and what exit velocity means. And launch angle means the vertical direction off the bat. So, you know, low launch angles below zero are going down into the ground, above zero are going up in the air. And then exit velocity is the speed that it comes off the bat. So generally what you want are high exit velocity and sort of intermediate launch angles. That's most likely to result in a productive batted ball. But there's a lot of complexity to this data that we're still just learning about now. Like for some batted balls, some line drives in particular, there's this kind of it's called the donut hole, where if you hit it, yeah, it's a good name. If you hit it at a certain exit velocity, it's going to be go over the infielder's heads and be a bloop single. If you hit it just a little bit harder, though, it's going to go to the outfielders and be a line out. And then if you hit it even harder, it's going to be a home run. So with those trajectories, with those launch angles, you have to be you have to know a little bit to know what's going to happen to that batted ball.
And the interesting there's so many interesting things, but the first thing I want to touch on is we see a lot on the telecast now, and even in stadiums, they're broadcasting, all right, he just hit that at 102 miles an hour. And it seems to me like that's an impressive number on the surface, but it doesn't tell you much. And that's kind of what you were saying in the piece, is that all that could mean is a hard ground ball to, you know, the shortstop if the launch angle is in downward or if it's flat. It seems to me like the exit velocity is almost like the pitch velocity in baseball. It might tell you what the pitch was, but it doesn't tell you much after that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good comp, right? I mean, it's sort of like the relationship between pitch velocity and pitch break, almost. You know, you can have a good launch angle and a low exit velocity, and it'll produce a single or a double, and that's fine. You can have a very hard hit ball, but on a bad trajectory, and it's going to result in an out. So it's sort of like with a curveball. It could be a slow ball, but if it's breaking, if it's 12-6, then it's still hard for the hitter to see, and they're going to swing and miss. So it's kind of like the same sort of relationship. You have to take into account both things at the same time, both the exit velocity and the launch angle.
And do you think we'll start seeing, like we're seeing on, and I'll just go on the scoreboard of the game, you know, we see exit velocity written up there. Are we also going to see launch angle put up there at some point?
Yeah, I think we will. I think it'll be really interesting to me to see how the teams start engaging with this in terms of media. But, I mean, launch angle is, I guess, a little bit easier to intuitively measure in your head. I'm not sure why exactly that is, but, you know, you can tell if it's a pop-up, you can tell if it's a fly ball, you can tell if it's a liner, right? But it's really hard to get an intuitive sense for, you know, how many miles per hour the ball left the bat just from seeing it. But I do suspect that in the long run, they'll start putting up those stats about it. And it'll be interesting, you know, to see if they start putting up what we expect to happen to this batted ball. That would be, maybe it'll ruin the suspense, you know, if like in the instant between Giancarlo Stanton hitting it and it finding a fielder's glove, you know, it pops up on the scoreboard, oh, this is going to go to a fielder, you know, that would be terrible. But it'll be funny how the teams engage with this.
So, and my next question is, if they start using this, I think in general, maybe the last big statistical, I don't know, revolution or big thing that happened recently was kind of OPS. And now we see that on a lot of broadcasts. And people may not understand the casual fan may not understand what it means, but they understand, okay, high number, good, low number, bad.
Right.
Do you think that it's still going to be kind of the similar way with launch angle and exit velocity? Like, okay, I understand that a pop-up's going to go straight up. I understand the harder you hit a ball, the better. Is that kind of where you think the casual fan's going to get to?
I hope so, but, you know, like I said, it's a little bit more complicated than just OPS. I mean, there's never a point at which more OPS is a bad thing. You know, if you can add OPS ever, then that's great for you as a hitter. On the other hand, exit velocity is just a little bit more involved than that. I mean, we went back to go back to that analogy you made about pitch velocity. You know, it might just be the type of stat that you need to have a little bit of baseball knowledge to really fully understand. So that when you see that, you know, a certain pitcher is throwing really, really hard, but they have a very straight fastball, well, you know that that doesn't necessarily mean that they're a great pitcher. So, I think that this is always going to be a little bit more complicated than just like a straight rate stat where, you know, higher is better, lower is worse.
And at the end of your piece, you kind of alluded to the fact that pitch FX was maybe the last big, big
breakthrough.
Yes, thank you. I would have choked on that for a while. Thank you. And you pointed out that then led into catcher framing and that metric, which has been such a big deal, kind of as an offshoot. Do you have any things that you might want to speculate or places where this information could then take us?
Well, I think that one of the interesting early directions that I've been really, really fascinated by is because this information is so accurate about what should happen to a batted ball, it gets really much more into a hitter's skill much faster than if we were looking at like their OPS, for example. And looking at that, you tend to see these interesting changes over time. So, like, one of the best examples I've seen recently is Ryan Zimmerman's exit velocity last year in the first 3 months was way low. And then in the last 3 months, it went all the way up. It went up like 5 miles per hour or something like that. And between the 2 months, he said that he had an injury and he felt much better. So we've usually said that, like, when a player is performing at a certain level over a certain season, he's just kind of that same level over the course of the whole season. But what the exit velocity is starting to show is that players can have these kind of streaks where for a while they're not doing so well, maybe because of an injury, maybe because they're uncomfortable, maybe their swing's not right, who knows. And then all of a sudden they can go up to a much higher true talent level and behave as though they're hitting much better. And this level of information is sort of laying those patterns bare and allowing us to see them. So I know that Russell Carlton has written a little bit about this for pitchers, and he found that pitchers' skill at decreasing exit velocity tends to fluctuate over the season in an interesting way. I've done a little research looking at hitters, and I found something similar, that hitters go through these streaks where they're very hot and they're hitting the ball much harder. If I had to guess, I think that that will be the next major thing that's going to come out of this data, is we're going to learn that actually players do go through hot and cold streaks, their ability fluctuates over the course of the season as they get injured or as they change their swings or whatever.
And maybe when we think of a hot streak now, we think of how hard they're hitting the baseball rather than how they're seeing the baseball.
Right, exactly. Hmm. And that's, you know, a better predictor of what's going to happen. Usually than what actually happened. You know, if a player hits a ball really hard, but the wind was against it and it went out for a lazy, you know, warning track fly, that probably bodes well for them the next time they go up to the plate, rather than just saying they had a fly out and that's that.
That's really interesting, and I could definitely see how that's the next frontier. That's interesting. Good luck with your work, because I'm really interested to see where you take that.
Oh, thank you. I hope it'll come out sometime this summer.
And the next piece I wanted to talk to you about was that you wrote about a week earlier than that. It was talking about older hitters are declining, but it's not because they can't catch up to the fastball, which I thought, I believe Joe Sheehan kind of came up with that hypothesis or just that thought. And I guess without ruining the story, you kind of prove that not to be the case.
Yeah. Sheehan came out in a piece in his newsletter. He suggested that maybe the reason that we're seeing this, you know, incredible production from young guys is because average pitch velocity has increased so much. And it's really a, you know, tremendous change. I mean, so there's the average pitch has gone so much higher. I think we showed that, know, more than 20, almost 30% of pitches are above 95 miles per hour now. And, you know, back 10 years ago, that would have been like a really good pitch. Now it's just kind of like a meh pitch. So, you know, he was saying like, well, who's going to suffer when you have a 95 mile per hour fastball? It's going to be the guy that's older. He has a slower reaction time. He's going to be the one that can't catch up to that. And that sounded pretty plausible. So Ben and I were pretty excited when we saw this. We were like, oh, maybe this is the reason. But then we get into the data a little bit, and it doesn't really reflect that at all. In fact, we found that not to ruin the story, as you said, but we found that older hitters, they don't really see any decline against fast pitches. They seem to, once you're at a certain level over your career, it seems like you just stay at that level in terms of velocity, and you don't really change.
Now, could it be the fact that Joe is right with his hypothesis, but it's the fact that these I don't know, 500 players, whatever the sample size is, are just, you know, the outliers, for a lack of a better way to put it?
It's possible. You know, the older guys who make it longer, they're definitely a non-random sample. We tried to get rid of any kind of survival bias by looking at, by using what's called the Delta method, where we looked at how, you know, if a hitter at age 34 plays and then he plays again at age 35, does he do worse at age 35 than he did at age 34? And typically we didn't see any change. But that doesn't necessarily prove it. So it's certainly a concern, but to the best of our ability to show, it doesn't seem like the hitters that survive in the league longer, doesn't seem like they have any particularly unusual talent for hitting fastballs.
Then what did the data kind of lead you to conclude? Where did it kind of shift your thinking?
You know, ultimately, we ended up with this kind of mystery. We don't know exactly what's happening. I mean, there's a few things. It could be that the hitters are, the older hitters are having to cheat on these fastballs. So they know that they're going to get a certain number of 95 mile per hour fastballs. So they look for that and they kind of load up for that. But then when they get a curveball, that confuses them because they're expecting this super fast fastball. And they actually do worse on curves. We didn't see any evidence for that either, but you know, it's really hard to rule that out. You know, it's hard to show that someone is sitting on a fast fastball. So, absent that, like, it's really hard to tell what exactly is going on with the younger hitters and being so much more productive. I mean, my personal hypothesis is that it's related to steroids getting out of the game. You know, when we saw the oldest hitters being so good, that was really around 2000, and that was probably the height of the, you know, so-called steroid era. Since then, it's just sort of gone way, way, way down. And, you know, the problem is we don't really have – there's not much for data to say about that because we don't know who was using. We don't know everyone who was using. We know some people who are using, but we don't know everyone who was. And we can't, you know – calculate the effect of steroids for older hitters versus younger hitters. It leaves us with this sort of mystery about what exactly is happening now. But you know, in the absence of any other evidence, that seems to me to be the best hypothesis for why this is happening.
Well, I think that makes total sense when you think about it as well.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in the sense that we saw some of the oldest hitters having really atypical and incredibly productive seasons, like Barry Bonds is the best example, you know, having these incredible best of all time seasons when he's 40 plus. That seems to lend credence to the idea that older players were getting some special benefit from steroids. But, you know, then you have, you know, A-Rod using when he was, I think, fairly young, or possibly using when he was young, and he seemed to have been really good. So, you know, it's just hard to say. And I guess that's, to me, that's, as a sabermetrician, as someone who's really interested in exploring and understanding the game, that's sort of one of the underappreciated tragedies of the steroid era, is that we can't really tell what was going on. We can't make heads or tails of the stats from that time period because they're so messed up from people using steroids. So I know that's probably not the worst aspect of the steroid era, but it does frustrate you now when you're trying to do analysis.
Well, it's 15 years of tainted data, basically, and maybe right. It's more years than that.
Right, and the most recent 15 years. So like, so many things have changed since the steroid era. I mean, that's really one of the sort of themes of the piece, right? Pitch velocity's gone up, but so, you know, that changed, but so did so many other things. So, you know, what's happening now? Well, I mean, all we can really say is, shrug.
Yeah.
We don't know.
And as Sam Miller jokes all the time, you can't compare the game after, 1987? So it's, if you eliminate the 15 years of data, you kind of start running into, it's a different game.
Yeah, exactly. It's a different game, and it's different in ways that we can't really understand.
Final topic I want to ask you about just a little bit is talking in the Chicago Cubs.
Yeah.
I don't even know really what to say. They're playing great baseball. Dexter Fowler is playing out of his mind, might be the most valuable player or one of the most valuable players in baseball. Arrieta's thrown a no-hitter. I don't know how he's doing as we're recording today, but...
I thought he wasn't doing so well, but that's all right.
Yeah, I thought I might have saw something on Twitter about that. But your thoughts on the Cubs? I mean, is this who we thought they were? To quote Dennis Green,
it is, and that's what makes it more exciting. You know, it's really tough usually to get excited about early season results because you know anything can happen over 20 games. But when you have a team that we projected to be the best in the league. Being even better than we projected them to be over 20 games, then you start to have some idea that it's for real because you have a prior belief, and then that's only backed up by the more data that we're getting. I think what's been surprising though is just how far above the rest of the league they've been. They have a run differential of 3.5 runs per game in their favor. The next best team is St. Louis with 2.3. So they're basically like 50% better than the second place run differential. And that's just ridiculous. So I doubt that will last for the whole season. But, I mean, for right now, it's like it's incredible to see how well they're doing and just how much they're stomping the competition.
And correct me if I'm wrong, they're playing below their Pythagorean, one-loss record expectation as of now.
Yeah, I mean, their Pythagorean record with luck sort of subtracted is 750. So they it's even better than that. It's 800. They should have a Pythagorean record of 16-4 according to Baseball Reference. I'm looking right now. I mean, that's just crazy, right? Like you never see that.
Particularly in that division. I mean, you could see that in some of the other weaker divisions in baseball this year, right? Particularly if depending on who you've played. I mean, the Nationals are coming to mind immediately, but Cubs have got to play St. Louis and the Pirates and a lot of good teams. The Reds have played pretty good baseball.
Yeah. It's surprising. They really made a mess of their Reds. I mean, that must have been tough to watch. especially the no-hitter and the 16-0 in the same game. That was pretty brutal. You'd think they would be doing a little bit worse just because of the quality of competition that they're facing, but they're still doing really well.
I'd love to get your take on Arrieta and the no-hitter and keeping him in when it was a 16-0 game. The main reason I ask is because I've been a very, very strong critical voice of why he was in the game in the first place, and maybe that was just my take that no-hitters aren't the biggest thing that they were 15 years ago. But as a fan and as an analyst, what were your thoughts on him staying in and throwing 120-something pitches?
Yeah. I have sort of two different perspectives on this. Like you said, depending on my identity as a fan versus my identity as an analyst. From the fan's perspective, it was just awesome to see. And it was one of those games that just like seems like it's going to be emblematic of the whole season, right? Like just that domination that was happening and Arrieta doing so well. I mean, it was awesome. So from the fan's perspective, I was absolutely like, let him stay out there, let him finish this game, let him get another no-hitter. It's amazing. From the analyst perspective, though, it was a little bit worrying, and he has shown some signs of wear at different times, particularly last year's playoffs. And so I always worry that he's sort of on the edge of a breakdown. So it did scare me a little bit from that perspective to see how his pitch count was climbing. And hopefully that's not the reason that we're seeing a bad Arrieta start today. usually I'm not so excited about no hitters. I think it was just because the context of the season and the way it was so dominating and the way it lined up so nicely with his story.
Yeah, I understand that. I just, goodness gracious, I think there's been 25 no hitters in the last 5 years. I mean, basically it's a once a month kind of thing in the last few years, and I just don't think it's the feather in the cap that it was. If you're an Armando Galarraga or somebody who's, and I don't want to say a great pitcher because that's not fair. Everybody in the majors is, but it's a feather in their cap for those kind of guys. But Jake Arrieta is, if he's not the best pitcher in baseball right now, he's the best three. He doesn't need a no hitter to prove his excellence to me. I just thought it was a mistake in April with somebody that's had arm troubles before.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a fair perspective. And if I had to guess, I would guess that there were people in the front office that were saying that at that moment. But, you know, I bet to Arrieta himself, getting that no-hitter was a big deal. And, you know, it was historic in another sense. I don't know if you saw this stat being batted around Twitter, but I think it was like the second shortest gap between no-hitters ever, or the third shortest or something like that. I mean, so it does highlight just how dominant he's been in the past year or so. So in that sense, it might have felt like it was a bigger deal to him and to the team than if it had just been, you know, him throwing just another no-hitter.
Yeah, I certainly see the other side. Rob, I could talk baseball with you all day, but I think this is a good place for us to cut the conversation and give you a spot for your plugs, where they can find you on Twitter, where they can find your writing, and basically anything you want to plug.
Oh, sure. So you can find my writing mostly on 538. I will be freelancing from time to time, as I've done in the Wall Street Journal and Slate and elsewhere. You can follow me on Twitter at @no_little_plans. Stay tuned to my Twitter feed and you'll see whatever it is that I'm doing most lately.
And that was my final question, is what is the meaning behind no little plans? Am I missing something obvious?
No, it's a quote from one of my favorite people, Burnham, who is this Chicago architect. And he said, make no small plans, for they have no power to stir men's blood. And so the idea is, if you are more ambitious and you make exciting projects for yourself, then perhaps you'll be more successful in the long run. Sort of a different way of saying, you know, reach for the stars, and that way you'll get to the moon.
I like it. Okay, that makes sense. I've always wondered what the meaning was behind it. That's very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Rob, thank you so much. Maybe there's a chance I'll see you in Chicago when I visit in a couple weeks.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to having you on hopefully sometime in the future.
Thanks for having me on.
And that was episode 65 of the Nats GM Show with my guest from 538, Rob Arthur. Wow, he's really been doing some great work, and just in the last few weeks. I mean, his work is great, but he's taken it to a whole nother level in the last couple of weeks. So really check out his work at 538 and follow him on Twitter at @no_little_plans. Thank you again for joining me. I want to give a special shout-out before I get out of here to the sponsor, No Halftime, and the No Halftime app. Please check them out. Very, very cool product, and I'm glad to have them as a sponsor for the show. We are done for this week. The show is a wrap. Bye for now.